another cameraman now in a very different field. Max Quinn worked on several New Zealand TV productions, historical dramas, behind the camera as well as director and producer. In 1987, he joined what was then TVNZ's Natural History Unit. Since he wintered over in Antarctica in 1991, I mean yeared over, not just wintered over, I think he was there for 10 or 11 months, he's made over 15 documentaries there and in the Arctic, as well as elsewhere around the world. An extraordinary career, Max Quinn. He's told his story as one of the world's most experienced polar filmmakers in a book called A Life of Extremes, The Life and Times of a Polar Filmmaker. And he's currently on a book tour from where he joins us in, I think, Nelson. Hi, Max, how are you?
Good morning, Kim. Yes, I'm in Nelson. I had a book launch, I suppose you could call it, with the great Craig Potten down here at the Suta Art Gallery just the other night, and that went very well.
That would have been lovely. It's a strange buzz going on. Have you got a buzz going on in your...
Have I got a buzz?
You have?
I'm sorry. Can you hear something?
Can I hear something? I very much doubt that. Can you hear that
how's
buzz?
That?
Oh, that's much better.
I can't
better.
Hear a buzz at all.
Are you in control of the buzz? What took you to Antarctica in 1991, Max?
Well, I had an opportunity. I was asked to go down there. They were looking for a cameraman who could direct or a director who could shoot, and I filled the bill, and they sent me down there to make a film about emperor penguins. And, of course, back in 1991, there hadn't really been any films made on emperor penguins before. This predated, you know, the March of the Penguins and those other films that came along much later. So we went down there, and it was very experimental, really, and we were, in some respects, quite pioneering, and stayed at Scott Base and made something like 13 visits out to the Cape Crozier emperor penguin colony during that winter, and it was just an incredible experience.
You couldn't have stayed at Cape Crozier. You had to keep going and coming because it's a fair old way from Scott Base. It's about 85 Ks, isn't it?
Yes, it was. It was 85 Ks over the Ross Ice Shelf and across quite severely crevassed ground. So we had to be very, very careful and safety conscious, of course. Of course, they also wanted me to make a film about life of people at Scott Base. So we were having to juggle our filming schedule through the year so that I could work at Scott Base and also out at Cape Crozier. So we had it worked out to go out there at the key moments of the penguins' breeding cycle.
Had you already read one of the best books ever, Apsley Cherry-Garrard's Worst Journey in the World?
I had indeed, yes. It is an incredible read, and the opportunity to go down there and to travel out basically along the very same route that those three explorers back in 1911 made when they crossed the ice shelf to go out to the Cape Crozier penguin colony in the middle of winter. Because back in 1911, of course, they knew very little about emperor penguins and they wanted to collect eggs because they lay their eggs in the middle of winter, of course. And here we were going out in their footsteps, I suppose, 80 years later.
I loved his description of, you know, they tromped over there, nearly died, got the eggs, brought them back, you know, carefully carried all the way back. And I think he took them to the National Science Museum or the Natural Science Museum and said, look here, you know, emperor penguin. They said, oh, yeah, just stick him down somewhere.
That's right. I believe they weren't looked at for some years. But it was incredible to do that because one of the amazing things that we were able to do was to actually go out to the stone igloo that Edward Wilson and Cherry-Garrard and Bertie Bowers had built out there to live in. And the remains of that igloo still stand today. And you can even see a few of the artifacts in the bottom of the igloo. And we went out there exactly 80 years to the day, and it was absolutely gorgeous, still and clear, but bitingly cold. Of course, when they were out there, it was a howling blizzard that sort of blew their tent away and created havoc for them.
Those emperor penguins are extraordinary things. You stayed all that time so that you could cover virtually their life cycle, I suppose, did you?
Yes, that's exactly right. As I said before, we had to travel out at key times, and we sort of worked out when they were going to be forming their huddle, when they were going to be arriving at the colony from the sea ice, forming their huddle, when they were going to be laying eggs, and when the eggs were going to be hatching, and then through the various stages of the chick development. So we would work it out that we would head out there at those times and try to strike it right. Of course, it was an incredibly dramatic story, as I have explained in the book, because it's a story that was almost as interesting as the film itself and how we actually managed to achieve what we did. Because in the dark of winter, it's very hard to film penguins. Of course, they are literally in pitch black, even at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So we had to even take lights down with us and light the penguin colony. And that was sort of heart in the mouth stuff, because we had to be very careful not to disturb the colony in any way.
In fact, I think that the US National Science Foundation had some concern about you, your plans. They were worried that it was going to be disruptive to the breeding cycle because the chick numbers had been declining steadily over the years. How did you allay their fears?
Well, it was true. The scientists felt that, you know, enough work had been done on that penguin colony, and they didn't really were a wee bit apprehensive about us going out in case we did disturb it. But so as a result, we took a very standoffish approach, a very softly approach. And in actual fact, the year that we were there was one of the best years for chick hatching that had been recorded for many years. So we were quite proud of ourselves, really, that we took that approach.
It's terribly anthropomorphic, I know, but penguins are inherently hilarious, aren't they?
They certainly are, yeah. One famous shot that I took was a group of emperor penguins sitting next to their only hole that was open to them, access to the sea. And overnight it had frozen over with a very thin sheet of ice. And the penguins are sitting there waiting, and then one of them moved forward and walked out over the thin ice and suddenly crashed through the ice. And all of the other penguins suddenly barreled in and broke the ice up. And it was actually quite an incredible bit of behaviour to film that hadn't really been seen before. So, yes, they are incredible.
That went viral, didn't it, that piece of footage, quite some time after you'd shot it?
Yes, it did, yes. People used to get hold of the shot, animators around the world, and they would add another penguin standing next to the hole that would slap the penguin over the head or trip him up as he walked forward, and he'd crash into the ice. And I think there was one site where it had achieved something like 14 million hits.
Honestly, and I imagine in lockdown these things once again take off because people are desperate not only for something to watch but to laugh at.
Yeah, I suppose that's correct. Of course, this was back in the day when the internet was just beginning, so It was all new to everybody.
You actually shot the hatching of the eggs.
Yes, I believe we were the first people to actually film emperor penguin chicks hatching at that time. They hatch just as the sun is returning. They have it timed so that, and of course, you have to remember that the male is sitting on the egg, so the actual chick hatches on the male's feet. The female, after she lays the eggs, goes out to sea and fattens up and comes back, seems to time it brilliantly, comes back 60 days later to claim the chick back and to feed the chick. And so we were there just as the sun was rising, and because that was a crucial time for us. And of course, we saw the chicks hatching out of the eggs, which was just in a remarkable moment for me, and one that I'll never forget.
Isn't that interesting? So the female always comes back around the time of the hatching so that she can take over?
Yeah, absolutely. She comes back and she calls out because, of course, there are 1,000 birds in the colony. She calls out and they recognise their voice somehow, and they come together. And what they do is they then do a chick exchange. And this was a crucial bit of behaviour for me to film. And it took quite a long time to actually get, really, because the chicks, the birds are still in a huddle. And I managed to get a couple of birds, a pair that were isolated from the huddle, and they were working around and around and around, and the female trying to entice the male to give up the chick. And eventually, right in front of my camera, side on to me, it was an absolutely perfect view. She gave the chick up, he gave the chick up, and she took it onto her feet, and she then fed the chick, And that meant the male could now go out and he could feed up, because remember, he hadn't eaten for since probably when the sea froze over, probably way back in March. And this is now August. He had been just living on his body fat. And he can now go out and he can fatten up. And they do something like, I think, 12 or 13 shuttles, really, back and forward as the chicks gain weight and eventually fledge.
And apparent, and the way they exchange the chick between each other is so deft, the chick never really touches the ice, does it?
No, well, it's just momentarily onto the ice, and then immediately the mum snuffles the chick up onto her feet with her beak, and puts a belly pouch over the top of the chick to keep it warm. And they raise that belly pouch up and down, sort of regulate the heat. So it's sort of like minus 30 outside, but plus 30 inside, if you know what I mean, in terms of temperature. And that's how they do it. Quite remarkable.
A lot of your work has drawn attention to the environmental changes, the climate change. Do you worry about the lot of the emperor penguins and indeed the other penguins in Antarctica as a consequence?
Yes, I suppose so, although I'm not sure if there's been any major significant change down there amongst the penguins due to climate change just in the last few years. But certainly I think it may well affect the summer breeding penguins, the Adelie penguins, the Gentoo penguins, those penguins that come in to Antarctica to breed and then head off again during winter. Of course, the emperor penguin is the only one that stays there all year round. But I sort of got my first sense of climate change, I suppose, when I went to the Dry Valleys in that particular year to film at Lake Vanda, and they were concerned about the level of Lake Vanda rising, and they were worried that they might have to move the base or even close it down. And subsequently, I believe they have closed the base down because the lake level is rising. But probably I saw most evidence of climate change in the Arctic. When I first went up there and saw the polar bears stranded on land because the sea ice had headed off so far into the distance that the polar bears literally couldn't get back out onto the sea ice, which of course is their domain. And so they're stuck ashore in the northern coast of Alaska and around Canada. And and they get into trouble. They go into towns and they rummage through rubbish dumps and things like that, trying to eke out a meal. So that was pretty concerning to see that. And then up on the Greenland ice cap, of course, I saw quite a lot of evidence of the ice cap melting around the edges. So, there's a lot of evidence. Slumping permafrost is another one, too.
You talk in the book about the Sami reindeer herders in Norway, where the reindeers are literally starving.
Yeah, well, that's right. We were so privileged to be offered a chance to accompany the Sami reindeer herders on one of their herding. They herd their reindeer from the central part of Sami land, or it used to be known as Lapland, to the coast where the warm current causes luxuriant growth at the coast. So they take them to the coast to fatten them up. But in the winter, there's not a lot of snow falls in the inland part, so they take the reindeer herds inland. And they can then use their hooves to break through the snow cover and eat the mosses and lichens. But the year that we were there, there had been a very warm spell right in the middle of winter, and it had melted the snow, and the snow had melted and then refrozen. And so there was actually a blanket of ice, and the reindeer just could not break through this blanket of ice. And a lot of them were starving, and they were having to feed them out hay as they to get them to the coastline, and we were able to go along and film this little drama taking place. A lot of the reindeer had to be picked up and put on sleds, and we were even helping them ourselves to get them to the coast so they could get a decent feed. And as it turned out, when they finally got to the coast, there was no green grass for them because the snow was so thick at the coast. So it was a very dramatic moment for them. But, it was one of those things that just made an incredible sequence in my film.
Yeah. Did they mind you shooting that? Because that was, a terrible scene for them and for the herders.
Yeah, I think John Utsi, the head reindeer herder, just a young chap who was in charge of the herd, was probably a wee bit apprehensive about us filming that moment of it. But he was very generous to me and spoke very freely to me about the concerns that he had about the fact that the climate seemed to be changing and what effect that might possibly have on them in the future.
I just wanted to talk about something that you described with regard to the emperor penguins. It's the chicknapping. You know, we all assume that penguins are quite jolly and the worst thing they do is steal a couple of stones from each other, but they steal chicks.
Yeah, they do. Mainly what we refer to as the unemployed birds or non-breeders, you know, or the juveniles. So they sort of hang around the edge of the colony. And if a chick gets loose or jumps off its parents' feet and goes running across, it's set upon by a group of non-breeders and they fight over the chick. And, you know, in one particular case, blood was spilt. It was quite violent. And they were so intense on trying to claim this chick for themselves that at one stage, this rugby scrum of emperor penguins came barreling up and actually crashed up against my tripod leg. They were just totally unaware that I was even there.
And they don't want to harm it. They want to adopt it. Is that the suggestion?
Yes, they do. Yeah, they do. It's just, I suppose, the natural part of the process of learning how to nurture a chick. Earlier in the year, we saw the young juveniles practicing with balls of snow. So it's all a part of the their adaptation to that incredible environment.
You wonder why. I mean, who knows, evolution? But why would they decide to live there all year round and breed in those appalling circumstances?
Well, you know, it is an incredible story, and it's one that I probably couldn't answer for you, but it's true. Of all of the penguin species, and we often think of all of these penguin species coming from Antarctica, but they're all, I suppose, inextricably linked to the southern ocean. But the emperor penguin is the only one that has adapted to survive in Antarctica and breed there all year round. All other species of penguins head north, such as the vicious nature of the winter down there, where they can live and breed in temperatures down to minus 50 degrees Celsius. And the key to the success is the fact that they have evolved to be non-territorial. They don't defend a nest site like other birds do. Even other penguin species, they're, as you mentioned before, they're stealing stones off other birds' nests. But the emperor penguin doesn't have a nest. Its nest is its feet, I suppose you could say. And the egg is laid and taken up onto the feet of the male. And the male keeps the egg warm with its belly pouch in a big huddle against the most horrendous cold and howling blizzards right through the dark of midwinter. So it is an incredible story of adaptation to that environment.
Once you cut your teeth in the polar regions on that expedition, was it logical that you would carry on going to very cold places?
Well, I suppose once you get a reputation for cold places, jobs that come along that require filming in the polar regions tend to fall into your lap. And that's exactly what happened to me. I thought that after I'd finished the Emperor Penguin films and the Winter Over film, I could go on and do other things. But, which of course I have done. I mean, in a funny sort of way, my polar filming has only been a small part of my overall 50-year experience of making films. So
more books to come then, Max.
Oh, well, who knows? We'll see how this one goes, Kim.
But nevertheless, you retired, I think, last year from the TVNZ Natural History Unit. And off you went to Brazil. What were you doing there?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, I did retire, but then they asked me if I would go and work with another producer, cameraman from the Dunedin Natural History Unit. Incidentally, I'd worked for them all those years, a great unit, and it's still operating down there in Dunedin. And so we headed off to Brazil for what was a great way for me to hang up my light meter, I guess, because it was incredible to get up close and personal with just about every iconic creature in South America, or certainly in Brazil. I mean, we were close to jaguars and giant anteaters and anacondas and muriqui monkeys, the largest primate in South America. It just went on and on and on. It was an incredible experience, and it was just for a series of films that the Natural History Unit are making for National Geographic Wild, I believe. So, of course, I was just on this production as a cameraman only, so I wasn't involved in the post-production of the film. But it was a wonderful way for me to sort of finish my life of extremes.
Have you finished your life of extremes?
Well, we'll wait and see. COVID has sort of put a bit of a halt on everything that's going
on.
Well,
there is that. You were lucky to get to Brazil just in time, were you?
Oh, yes. I mean, I can't really see people getting back to Brazil or even doing a lot of filming for many years. So we'll just hopefully things will work out. But so I was very lucky to time it the way I did.
How big are the Mariki monkeys then?
Oh, they're known as the woolly spider monkey. They're a species of spider monkey, and they live right at the very top of the trees. And we were in a forest, the Atlantic Forest, inland from Rio de Janeiro, and we went searching for them. It took us 3 days to find them. And then when we did find them, we only saw them for about 15 minutes, but that was just enough time for me to get the camera set up and get on the old telephoto lens on, and to get quite a nice little sequence of them right at the very top of the trees. But a very rare and once again a real privilege to see that animal in the wild.
Are they
the
rare or just shy?
They are rare, I believe. They are rare. And we also filmed at the very other extreme, the very smallest of the monkey species, the lion tamarin monkeys, which are very, very rare. But we were able to see those in the wild as well, which was once again an incredible experience.
So did you have to, you know, trek through the jungle hauling your gear?
Yeah, we do that all the time.
But for
even
days.
Though I'm nearly 70 years old at the time, I still, I quite happily throw everything on my back and off we go, yeah. We had a little bit of help with us. We hired a few porters to help us carry our gear up the steep slope. But, yeah, that's just the way we work. It's been a great life to be able to work like that out in the wild.
You must be very fit, Max.
I'm not fit as I used to be, Kim.
Nobody's as fit as they used to be, Max, now are they? Although, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. What are you going to do with all this fitness now, all this residual fitness, if you're not tromping through the forest hauling your camera gear?
Well, I tell you what, writing books is certainly not a way not to get fit, you know. So whether I'll write another one or not, I don't know. As I said before, we'll see how this one goes.
You are the brother of Keith Quinn, of course, which, I mean, are you as interested in rugby as he is in wildlife? I've got no idea.
We were brought up, there are five boys in our family, and we're all brought up just a stone's throw, really, from Athletic Park in Wellington, the old rugby ground there. So that's where Keith got his interest. And the interesting thing is that he used to work during the school holidays and buy me a roll of movie film, and I would go down and shoot him playing rugby for the Wellington Rugby Club. And it was interesting that he went on to become a rugby commentator and I went on to become a cameraman and ultimately a producer and a director. So I worked very much behind the scenes and he was very much in front.
That's very nice. I thought out of the kindness of his heart he bought you some film, but no, it was so that you could shoot him on your camera.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yes, yeah. I would thread up the projector, the old little 8mm movie projector, and he would invite his teammates around and they'd sit on the living room floor and he would sort of do a mock commentary and I would do the projection job. So it's funny the way it's sort of followed us right the way through our careers.
What's the most fascinating place you've ever been to?
Oh, that's a tough one. Probably I'd have to say Antarctica, but I did have an incredible experience filming a nuclear submarine coming up through the ice. It was just across a flat plain of ice, but that was an incredible experience, one of the most incredible experiences that I've witnessed. But probably my time in Antarctica with the emperor penguins in the middle of winter, biting cold, minus 40 degrees, you know, everything going against us, the camera not working properly, you know, all of those things that I think back on. But I just look back on that moment as the moment of my life, really, being able to witness those penguins in the dark of an Antarctic winter.
When you were anticipating going there, you describe it in your book as a seemingly impossible undertaking. Was that because of the climate?
That as well. We had no idea how our cameras would operate in those conditions. So we had to I had to build covers for the cameras to keep them warm. And my sound operator, Don, he went and built a heat element to put on the camera that ran on a 12-volt battery. And all this was extra weight that we had to carry every day we went down to the colony, because we were actually, our huts were still an hour's walk away from the colony. So when we went down there, it was a long hike just to get down there and to get back up the hill at the end of the day.
It's been very nice talking to you. Where are you off to next on your book tour, Max?
We're going off to Twizel, I think. Look out, people of Twizel.
Look out, people of Twizel. Lovely to talk to you. Best of luck. Max Quinn, whose book's called A Life of Extremes, The Life and Times of a Polar Filmmaker.